Akron, Akron, Ohio. This is episode 220 of On the Tropes. On this week's episode, we are reviewing Daughters of the Dust, and we'll talk a little bit about its history and why we wanted to talk about it, and then we'll do kind of a summary and review of it. But first, as always, I'm your host, Nick, and today I'm joined by...
The
red mic and the black mic, but that's fine.
Sarah on the red mic.
And Eva on the black mic.
And I'm Nick on the blue mic. We've got a very, like, is there a flag that's those three colors?
Not that I can think of.
Yeah, I can't think of a red, black, and blue one.
It'll be the new On the Tropes flag. Ooh, I don't think anything. Ugh, I'm getting some, like, weird pictures, though. Anyways, so Daughters of the Dust, it is a 1991 film written, directed, and produced by Julie Dash. It was kind of like an underground hit. And then over just the last few years, like Cohen restored it and did a DVD release a few years ago. And since then, it's picked up a lot to become more of like this kind of art house darling. So where did you guys watch it? Did you guys watch it on Criterion?
Criterion.
Okay, so if you haven't seen this, one, it's streaming for free right now on CriterionChannel.com. It used to be on Netflix, but it was taken off apparently when I was looking into it.
So it's the first feature-length film by an African-American woman to receive wide theatrical release. I can't remember, like, vaguely when it came out-ish. You know, like, I mean, or around the era, like, I remember it being out in the 90s, like, and seeing the cover and seeing it on in different spaces. Yet it was definitely kind of like firmly within that art house kind of independent cinema vibe. And then
I think it played at Sundance. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. It was that this movie 16 years ago was selected for preservation into the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. So it's not just like, you know, film nerd type people revering this movie. It's made its mark, like, nationally, internationally. It's been influential on maybe most notably Beyonce in, I think, her Lemonade video, which I never saw in its entirety, but apparently that pulls some visual cues from this. You'd heard of it before? Have you heard of it before this, Eva? Before, like, recently?
No, I had not. I don't remember, like, hearing anybody talk about it or seeing it on TV or anything as a kid.
Speaking briefly of black art, Nick, I can't help notice that, is that Cavassier that you're...
This
it looks like the glass from the past the Cavassier music video.
No, it's it's Johnny Walker. So I hadn't heard of this until a few years ago. I don't know if you guys know Tim Payton. It's a Akron dude. He went to Firestone, his year behind me. Somebody had messaged me on Twitter just like out of the blue saying, hey, you should have watched Daughters of the Dust. And I didn't even like know his username. I was like, who is this? And he's like, oh, it's Tim. I'm like, okay. Cause he's a dude who, like, whenever I see him, I like, we talk about movies. So I put this on my watch list. I put it on my Amazon wish list actually, just so I would remember to pick it up. And my mom actually got it for my birthday 4 years ago, I think, the Cohen Blu-ray. So, I got it for my birthday, I think in 2017, and watched it then and was like gobsmacked at how unique this movie is. Like, something can't be more unique than something else, really, people say. But this is, like, with that caveat, one of the most unique movies I've ever seen. People make comparisons to other filmmakers, like Terrence Malick is one that comes up a lot. But even then, like, I don't think that's a very good... Or it's kind of like a facile comparison. I don't know of any other movie that's really like this one. So what did you guys think about Daughters of the Dust?
I think that what really struck me was how, you know, at the time, like in the 90s, this movie was in a kind of a genre of like black women's films almost. So it was kind of siloed in that way. And I think what struck me about it was how this one was like the most esoteric, most kind of like the deepest version of or example of that genre. So it would include movies like The Color Purple and Women of Brewster Place and things like that. Like, whereas this movie is the most like raw, the most quote unquote authentic and real. I mean, Color Purple is directed by Steven Spielberg.
I was going to say, it's definitely more authentic than, like, granted, like the source material, but yeah, The Color Purple is directed by a rich white man.
Yeah, I mean, this one's the most, I mean, it's the most black. Just the most really, yeah, just the most authentic and realist one was the first thing that just jumped out at me. And yeah.
And that's kind of like why we wanted to talk about this movie. Because we said we like last week, we said we wanted to talk about like a piece of black art that was more like affirming, or, you know, not about the horrible things. We wanted to watch something like, I mean, not that this movie doesn't have upsetting things and like challenging topics, but it's not all just about like tragedies and
yeah,
the horribleness. Because this movie, like the best parts about this movie, I think, are about like the beauty of this culture and these people and like the familiar relationships, the relationships with each other, and just seeing into this culture that, I mean, I had a like even only a vague familiarity with like the Gullah culture and this era where, you know, the movie takes place in 1902. So it's, you know, post Civil War, but it's not really post slavery, or like it sort of is, but they allude to like how, you know, there's still lynching going. Well, not that there's not still lynching going on now too, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's still current to a time of like real hardship and poverty with black folks. And, you know, I think you pointed out something that's really cool about the movie, though, is that it, while it does directly confront those topics, it doesn't, in its imagery, it doesn't wallow in them. It doesn't put black suffering on display, essentially, which is like very different from the 90s era. We just watched Dead Presidents, which, you know, I'd seen a bunch of times. Eva, I don't know if you had seen it before.
It had been, I don't think I ever saw it all the way through.
Yeah, and it's...
I think
it's
you had made me watch that. Not made me watch that, but you'd introduced that to me, like, probably 15 years ago when we were kids.
You know, and Dead Presidents is very much in a... It's part of another genre of 90s black movies that it's kind of the existential horror film. Mm-hmm. So they would be like Dead Presidents, Juice, Higher Learning. One of these days I'm going to write an essay about how those films are really, they're these existential horrors. You know, some of the imagery is just strikingly graphic and terrifying. And they're just about black life and the lens of black life during the 90s era. Yet, Daughters of the Dust is noticeably absent of any scenes of like oppression of black people, even right. though there is the I don't know if this is a spoiler. I think it's right there in a lot of the synopsis of the movie that there's one of the major plot points, you might say, or points is the rape of a black woman.
Mm-hmm. Not shown on screen, though.
Not like, shown on screen, I think, though. And that's so important that it's not shown in flashback that this happened or anything like that. And that's really, it's notable for the time.
Yeah, and you have to, the only way that you would be able to know that happened is if you're actually listening to the characters when they're talking. You have to, because they tell you about it. He's talking to his grandmother about what happened to his wife, but there's no flashback. There's no, you don't see it on screen when the great grandmother is talking about how things were for her and her husband. she's only talking about it. You don't get to see it, and you have to like actually be listening and paying attention to those characters to get that out of the film.
Yeah. And not only that, but they don't ever, maybe for this they do, they may say it explicitly, but a lot of the way that they talk is that they'll speak in like metaphor, they'll speak around things. So maybe he does at one point, like, I don't know if they ever actually say that she was raped. They just, you surmise that she was raped based on the way he phrases things, or maybe at first he doesn't and then later they do.
Yeah, I mean, they say it pretty plainly in vernacular. Like, I don't know if the word rape is ever used.
That's kind of what I meant.
Yeah, they have a lot of dialogue about it and processing, the characters process it together.
Right. So the one thing that I don't think they do say explicitly, before I forget, the one thing that I was going to say earlier when I like lost my mind, when my brain broke, is that like, we're going to spoil the movie, but I also think that I'm pretty spoiler sensitive, but this movie's not really that spoilable. Like all of the plot points happen in the first like 5 minutes or so. And then everything else is just kind of like these people, their relationships unfolding.
Yeah.
It's a very like nonlinear kind of ethereal way of telling a story, which is why I think she gets those Malick comparisons. I love the way Julie Dash like composed the story. Apparently the first draft of this, it was going to be silent. It was going to be a silent movie. And she like handed it to the producer or her agent or whoever. And they're like, yeah, we like it, but like, we're not going to make a silent movie.
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like this, like many other great films, has that balance of artistic freedom. And then people around the artist kind of nudging them toward, because I think like having the voices of these people and hearing them speak and turn, and that it goes hand in hand with something I'm going to bring up later about that's so great about it.
I love listening to the Nana talk. I don't know anything about that actress, but good Lord, she's so good in this movie.
Yeah. So like, plot of the film is essentially for those who don't know, the Gullah Geechee people are Black folks who live in America in the Carolina Islands, and the sea islands, they call them, in the low country region of the U.S. states. So it's Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina. And they have a Creole language called the Gullah language. And essentially they are African people who have, African Americans, quote unquote, that have kept their culture from Africa because they've been kind of isolated in the island areas. So they have a lot of their own land. They have a lot of their, of course, they have a lot of their own customs, bit of their own economy, things like that. And this movie,
their own religion.
Yeah. This movie is set in, was it 1901?
Yeah, 1902. But
1902, a Geechee woman who lives in Philadelphia, she goes home and brings her friend who's a photographer, a non-Geechee person, and he's there to photograph the family on like kind of their last big get together before they all leave the island.
Yeah. So basically the movie is like a family reunion before the majority of the family leaves the islands to go to the mainland that they think, you know, they'll be so much better off. And, you know, throughout the course of the movie, we see the pros and cons of them, like leaving their home, leaving their culture. So we start off, like you said, with Mary, who has lived on the mainland, like the regular part of the United States, for a while. They call her Yellow Mary, which I believe is like, why did they call her Yellow Mary? Was it a reference to her being like, because she's not much paler than, like,
yeah, she's, and they even say that, you know, it's yeah, it's like vernacular and naming cultures and mm-hmm. things like that. I mean, she's certainly very like unique and free spirited, quote unquote. So it goes untranslated why exactly the her name is that specifically. I can infer and think of a lot of different reasons within African American culture why she would be called that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know if I should go into that. You know, it's personal.
Yeah. Well, I think Viola alludes to it like pretty early on, but
yeah, she mentions it, and she kind of even says kind of what you said, that it's not necessarily literal. Not that she is, because basically, I mean, for those who don't know, biracial people, one of the vernacular terms in African American culture for biracial people is high yellow in the South, especially.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there's this interesting kind of visual dynamic happening in the film where Mary's lover that she brings home with her, Trula, is biracial black, would be considered, quote unquote, a high yellow person, mm-hmm. which, listeners, I really advise you, if you are not black, or even if you are black and you're from the North, you've never heard this term before, don't just start going around calling biracial people, black people, that. you know, context and all, and authenticity, all those things, just don't do it. So there's kind of that instant, like, cool, like, visual thing happening to us as mm-hmm. the viewers, where if you know about this vernacular term, you're like, oh, wait, well, that would be Mary's friend, yet her friend kind of represents partly Mary's relationship with her friend, represents her quote unquote otherness and her free spiritedness, is she's queer. Which really, you know, one more thing, like, I guess I think about, you know, it's untranslated. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things in this movie that are deeply set within African American culture. I mean, but that's part of what the movie is about, is how black culture, the iconography of black culture and our different practices travel throughout time, and we carry them throughout time. So the main character, one of the main characters, this would be Eli. He plays a kicking and like a fighting game with his friend. That's a thing called knocking and kicking. It's called knocking and kicking.
Is that like the wrestling match they do on the road?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a martial art called capoeira in Brazil. That's like kind of this dance martial art that originated from slavery. Black Americans had a similar one.
It's featured in Bob's Burgers. If you're not familiar with capoeira, there's an episode of Bob's Burgers about it.
Yeah. So that's in Brazil. Black Americans have a similar thing called, we call it knocking and kicking here in the Georgia area. So it's something that happens within the film, and yet it's not translated for the audience. Yet you, as the viewer, like, because Eva, you didn't know about it either, like, you still get it though. You get you get the purpose of it. There's no need to have this have a character explain what it is or have them.
Yeah, that's.
And I think that's so beautiful about this movie, is she finds ways that for folks like me who recognize things, we're like, oh, wow, this is so cool to see this on film. And yet it doesn't leave you out as somebody who's like further out from the culture.
Yeah. And especially because the movie has a character, the photographer, the dude from Philadelphia, that we assume is more Northern, that was an opportunity that somebody else making this movie would have, either the photographer walking around asking people, well, what does this mean? Or what is this, you know, what are you guys doing? Or something like that. And it would be a way to explain those things to the audience more by explaining them to that character. And yet the movie doesn't do that. It just shows these people existing, and it's like a silent film. That's really interesting that you said that earlier about that it was going to be a silent film, because that's how I felt about some of the dialogue.
Yeah.
That there were moments that I didn't get every bit of the dialogue, but it didn't make me feel like I didn't know what was happening or how people were feeling. You can read the whole thing and you can get it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I want to circle back a little bit to something that Eva and I were talking about off air right before you joined the Zoom call, sir. So you mentioned Yellow Mary brought a companion, and she's much more light skin. Her name is Trula. She's not much younger, but she's younger. So it's never explicitly stated her relationship to Yellow Mary. And I think I have the same, like, Eva and I both said that we'd, you know, briefly entertained one reading of it, that she's not her lover, but she is her daughter. Now that's, I'm mostly playing devil's advocate, because I do think that it is probably her lover and not her daughter. But the one thing that I said I wanted to say for the show, Eva, is that I think that the one thing that makes me not totally want to cast that reading of it aside is that she is so much more light skinned. And later we learn about Yellow Mary, and when she's in the States, she goes to work for some family, and they basically like enslave her and take her to Cuba and don't let her leave.
She's a wet nurse for them because she lost her baby.
Right. Right. But she does say that like they basically didn't let her go.
Mm-hmm.
I think she says that she says something to the effect of, she had to stay there until she like wasn't able to function as a nurse anymore, and they wouldn't let her.
Said she fixed herself so that she couldn't nurse.
Yeah, anymore.
Right.
And so I didn't know.
Another thing, like that's another untranslated moment that's really important to the story, yet isn't translated on film.
Yeah.
So for her to say she fixed herself, that's. So it's called like conjure, it's called hoodoo, different, basically the knowledge of herbs and an old medicine. And so she essentially like does it on purpose, causes herself to stop giving milk.
Lactating. Okay. Yeah. And I wasn't sure if that was something like that, or if she, like what exactly she was referring to, but either way, it sounds like she was not in, you know, a good situation when she was basically forced to go to Cuba as a wet nurse. So that, like, I think that coupled with how much more light skinned Trula is, does kind of fit with the reading of like maybe it is her child. That being said, I still do agree that that's mostly playing devil's advocate. I do think it is her lover, but I like this movie that they don't go out of their way and explain any of it. And Trula doesn't say a single word in the movie.
She says one thing.
She says when she's talking to the kids,
they're looking at a Sears catalog. Like a Sears,
yeah.
What is she? I don't remember what she says.
She talks kind of like a kid almost.
She's talking about something she likes in the cat, it's like a memory.
Hmm. It's something she wants, and she she wants a bunch of them, or she wants something that she points to it in the catalog. Okay. And she's sitting with all the little kids when she does it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm more obviously Wikipedia isn't the authority on.
I saw that the Wikipedia plot summary does call it.
They seem to be drawing. I wonder what they're drawing on. Whether that's a. Are they drawing from the script? Are they drawing from conversation with Julie, or from accepted, coming directly from the actors, or what? Yeah.
So there is an audio commentary with Julie Dash on the Blu-ray. And I only got to listen to about a half hour of it, which it's a great commentary so far anyway, because there's a lot of like symbolic things that I didn't get. obviously, like, not surprisingly, that's why I wanted to listen to it, because this movie's like so heavy in symbolism. But when it first shows the two of them, well, not just the two of them, but the boat that features mm-hmm. Yellow Mary and Trula, she starts talking about how, like, Yellow Mary's coming back and she's here with her mystery companion, and she, like, for that whole part of the conversation, she never clarifies, like, who Trula is. So I think, like, it wasn't like a mistake that we don't know any more about her relationship mm-hmm. or their relationship together. Like, it was a decision.
Yeah. And, you know, I support it. I think there's one moment where Yellow Mary has her arm around Trula's waist that's fairly intimate, you know? And I think, like, to me, it speaks to the complexities of Black queer identity and the need to like obscure it in mm-hmm. the time they were living in. I think it speaks a lot to that. There's also a moment where when they arrive and meet the rest of the family, the derision, like, there's a certain amount of derision that some of the family members have for Yellow Mary, and specifically for her companion that she's brought there. I think one mm-hmm. of them refers to her as the thing. There seems to be, you know, and this is one of the major conversations in womanism and just Black feminine kind of discourse in America, is just this tension between traditional Black quote-unquote family structures and queer identity, and needing to kind of hide it or not being able to be really open about it. So I kind of felt like some of it was that too, is reflecting on that and through the movie.
Yeah. What was the line that you'd mentioned off air, Eva? Somebody makes a comment that,
it's one of the aunts. And I want to say, was her name Hagar?
Yeah.
And it's when, like, Mary and was it Viola mm-hmm. was the woman who kind of, like, you know, commissions.
Yeah, so Viola's the one. She's the other woman who's been living on the mainland. She's been living.
Right. She's the one who got really religious. Yeah. But what's interesting, real quick, is she's not religious in a way that she rejected her queer relative and said, "You can't come with me." You know, she's like, "Oh yeah,
Viola is that." Whereas Hagar, supposedly also religious, is.
It seems that way because she says something like, as they're approaching, we're kind of going back and forth, and that aunt says something like, you know, like, I can't remember exactly how it sounds. It's something to the effect of, like, well, who does she think she is? Or she, mm-hmm. Yellow Mary's finally coming back. Like, mm-hmm. just look at her or something like that. And she says something like, and she brought her with her.
Yeah.
It's something. And that's like, it seems to be that they know. It's not like any of them don't know who Yellow Mary's companion is. But again, the movie doesn't make a big deal out of it. Like, the movie doesn't make it a plot point that, you know, why is she coming back here with her partner? Or her partner can't sit with us, or we can't let her partner around the children, or something like that. Like, she's just there. She's there to the point that no one talks to her, and we don't know what her name is.
Her name is Trula. They say it, I think, on the boat. But I don't think I like have everything written down. So otherwise, I don't think they say it.
I didn't think they did. Like, the part where she introduces Yellow Mary, she does.
I thought that. Yeah.
They mention it real briefly early on, but I don't think it ever gets repeated.
And then they don't, you know, like you said, they don't really interact with her or talk with her.
Yeah. It's not like people are going like, Hey Trula, how was your trip?
Mm-hmm.
So we even talked about kind of like the structure of the movie, which is, you know, like I said, it's loose. It's loose and flowing. There are multiple narrators. So the main narrators are Nana, who's the matriarch of the family. She is the great grandmother of Eli. So she's up there. And then the other narrator is the unborn child of Eli and Eula, which I don't know of any other movie that has an unborn person narrating. I think that's kind of
certainly
cool.
not such a believable,
right,
and steady narrator.
Like, I haven't seen it. Yeah, I haven't seen it in years, but maybe Look Who's Talking does that.
A little bit. Yeah, not quite the same.
These are around the same era, so maybe it was something that was like a part of the zeitgeist at the time. Maybe if we look back, there's a lot of early 90s, late 80s movies with fetuses narrating.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's Look Who's Talking. Pretty much it. The pinnacle of Hollywood's answer to that.
So, yeah.
There's a lot of movies that try to do this non-linear interweaving stories through time and things like that. None of them is effectively this film, in my opinion. Like, the way it does it is so perfect. At times, I actually thought at first that we were like seeing scenes from the past. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk about Nana's like husband, and I was like, wait, are we seeing this? And no, we're actually not. Like, it's always in the present, quote unquote, except for one very brief moment at the very end. We're always in 1902, yet we experience and hear and feel the stories of the past the same way that this family would, just sitting around remembering these moments, and like, you know, we feel the emotional kind of resonance that the moments carried in their stories and in their interactions and understandings of each other. And it's just, it's really masterfully done. Like, it was never a point where I felt confused. Ebert had a great thing where he said about the movie, like, he's like, it wasn't like, and I'm paraphrasing him, he's like, it wasn't like everything was perfectly laid out to me yet by the end of the movie. I understood everything that had happened. Mm-hmm. And I really like got that sense of this, that like, yeah, everything was dotted by the end of it. I felt like I'd seen a complete film. And
yeah, even if like beat by beat, not everything, like, you may not be able to write the novelization of this, but you can still understand it on an emotional level, or like that type of storytelling, which is like very much a Nick movie. That's like totally my jam.
Yeah. The parasols on the beach.
Oh yeah, those parasols. More movies need to throw parasols on beaches. I only know of one.
A horse running.
Well, there is, so there's a scene where Nana I think has a vision of the unborn child running on the beach. That was like my reading of it anyway.
Well, like, the unborn child appears a couple times, not as a child, maybe around like 5-ish mm-hmm. years old. Mm-hmm. And the photographer sees her.
I think that he is the only person
that
sees her. And he only sees her because, you know, you kind of imagine, because he sees her through the camera lens.
Yeah. And with the child says that Nana is who called her, you know, Nana kind of like helped form her in a way, you know, and she says something like, you know, she helped me, or she called out to me and I came at the right time, mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. I really liked that moment when, is his name Steven? The photographer?
I know it's Mr. Sneed.
He's looking through the camera, but it's like a callback to when they were on the boat on the way there, when they're looking through the kaleidoscope.
Kaleidoscope, yeah.
And he's talking about how it's mirrors, you know, that make this like magic image. And so then he's looking through the camera and he sees this that nobody else sees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also love the kaleidoscope imagery, just in that like, it's something that like, it's a fragmented representation of something, but it all kind of makes sense. And he explains like the physics of how it makes sense. And that's sort of how this movie is. Like, it's fragmented and it's like seemingly scattered, and yet all the pieces actually do fit together.
Did you ever take apart a kaleidoscope?
I never have. No,
I broke one as a kid. I remember we had it like, and I took it apart, and yeah, once you take it apart, it's not at all what you thought was it's just like these little chips of colored something, and you know,
three
mirrors in a triangle, And yeah, it's like the individual pieces that make it up are kind of like mundane or underwhelming, but the way that they interact together make this whole other thing that you can't see outside of the kaleidoscope.
This is not going to work on Zoom, let alone the podcast, but I got this thing where it's like two rounded mirrors and you can see there's a, like I put a guitar pick in there, but the way the mirrors work is it makes it look as if it's up here and you try to grab it and it's actually like 3 inches below. So I put it in front of my kid because it came with like a little toy frog. I put it in front of her and she was very amused by it. There's one subplot that it's a pretty small subplot, but I really like how it unfolds. And it really doesn't need that more. Like in the very beginning, one of the younger women who's named Iona has a letter written to her from a Cherokee man named St. Julian Lastchild. And basically the letter just says, you know, like we grew up together. It seems like they were lifelong friends and then presumably lovers. It doesn't say that explicitly, but he says, I feel if I lose you, I will lose myself. And he's basically begging her not to leave. But it's said right after that letter is read that Iona is not going to be allowed to, they're not going to let her stay. Like she's too young to stay. But if we jump ahead, we don't really hear about it for the rest of the movie until the very end when the family's leaving. And it's just the nice little like, oh, remember this thing that we haven't talked about in an hour and a half? It's back. We see this guy running towards the boat as they're leaving on his horse. And she's like, yeah, I'm not getting on that boat.
Oh yeah. And it's a great like moment for Hagar's character too. I'm trying to remember if it's her, it might be Nina, who talks about the naming convention that the Geechee and Gullah people had. Mm-hmm. So they would name their children My Own or Iona because for them, having grown up in slavery, to have some way to claim these children as their own was like really important symbolically. So Hagar is this woman who thinks that she's pro personal freedom and advancement and people making their own decisions and that she's this kind of free woman.
She's the Gullah Ayn Rand, is that what you're saying? Yeah.
So Jesus. So you know, of course, and I mean are we spoiling, is this a spoiler?
Yeah.
It's gonna be a spoiler if we do that. So you know, St. Julian Lastchild with a great name shows up and Iona gets on the horse and rides off and you get this wonderful moment that you couldn't recreate in any other film of Hagar coming off the boat and screaming, I own her. Mm-hmm. Like yelling after them, like I own her. And it's this great inversion of the reason for those names that literally lifted up this kind of, it was, they were a symbol of freedom of the family that they owned, that they had owned themselves. They own their own, quote unquote, could have their own children. Mm-hmm. And yet now in this modern context, it's turned into this kind of somewhat toxic thing of like social control. It's just incredible. Like, I mean, the movie has, that movie is like a whole year of like just teaching Black culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just really incredible.
And I love not just on like that very specific level, but just generally the movie, you know, it's about this family. Should they go to the mainland or not? And I don't really know, like, should they? Maybe. I don't know. It seems like it's maybe the right decision for some of them. And then for others, it's very clearly not the right decision. And, you know, not to like, we're spoiling it. Not all of them end up going. Some of them decide that they should stay. They're better off staying. And I think that's, I think it's important that some of them do end up leaving, but a significant number of them and the ones that we seem to know the best decide that, you know, they're better off being there and they're better off being, you know, with their Nana. Like that's something that the kid says that she was, I think early on in the movie, they might even say, like, they might imply that that is going to be the first child who's born in the North or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not, she's born on the island and the Nana's like still around to see it. Whereas, there's a great scene early on when Eli is talking to the Nana and he's like, you know, we're leaving. That doesn't mean we don't love you. And, you know, family's important and all that stuff. But it's made very clear that when they leave, they're not going to see her again.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sad. Like it's like a sadness that hangs over most of the film. And I think it plays a big role as to why some characters, and most specifically Eli doesn't end up leaving. There's also like in that same scene, I think that is the scene where it's revealed that they allude early, like before that, to them having trouble conceiving. Like they show their bed and then like some of the like herbs and stuff that are supposed to be, at least in my reading of it, supposed to be like fertility related. It's in that scene that he's talking with Nana and it's revealed that Eula is pregnant, but it may be pregnancy due to a rape. And he's, he says something along the lines of, I feel like she's not mine anymore. And Nana says, she never belonged to you. She married you, which is just such a great, like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a great moment of like, I mean, I struggle with these movies, the term like women's films and things like that. I think when we look at who influenced Julie Dash, you know, she cites Toni Morrison and Alice Walker, and I'm not going to get into the difference between womanism and feminism because I'm not the person to really break that down for folks yet. There is definitely a conceptual difference between kind of like pro women's philosophies in the Black community and like traditional feminism. And this movie is like the most womanist film ever made. And it's so great because the men are not centered, yet they're not denigrated. They're not like, they're not placed as the enemy. Yet there are those beautiful moments like that where the toxic masculinity of the day is like directly confronted and like named and shut down. And it's just really cool. Yeah, that's a great moment. I think one of the other things I think about is like how the values and beliefs of all of the people on the island are listened to like really equally in the film. The film doesn't make a choice about, for example, Yellow Mary being, you know, she's this kind of forward, very progressive. She sees herself as a really progressive woman of the times. And yet the movie doesn't make this decision that she's the most intelligent, that's how everyone should be, or anything like that. It lets them all speak, hold their own identity. Like there's that great moment where they're kind of on the beach and it's when Nana's starting to get kind of going on like you're preparing for this big moment where she's going to bless the family, and Hagar is kind of like really giving her a hard time, and they're all kind of just expressing how they feel about their identities and who they want to be in life. And it's like they're all allowed to kind of hold that equally. It kind of speaks to what you were saying about some of them decide to stay, some decide to go. Yet they all make that individual decision themselves, and it's all they make the right decision for themselves, I should say.
Hagar's pretty mean to the
She's
Nana.
Pretty mean. Yeah.
Like it's she says some stuff like I don't think Nana is there when she says it, when she like goes on her big rant. I think it's to the other family members about her.
Well, she does say that stuff too. There's a scene where they're like they're in the scene together by themselves, and she's saying a lot of the same. I actually thought the same thing, like, well, she didn't really say it to Nana's face, and then she kind of does, and I'm just thinking like, wow, it's risky.
She says some rough shit, and I do feel like the movie, like there's a lot of ambiguities, or ambivalence, I guess, in where the movie kind of wants you to think, like what you're, like you said, it's portraying people like there are different beliefs being shown and different, you know, lifestyles, and it's not really judging any of them. I do feel like it kind of judges Hagar a little bit as being like just a little bit too hard. Not a little bit. She's far too hard on the Nana. And like one of the recurring themes of the movie is like talking about your ancestors. And like, dude, Hagar, like she's your elder. Like, show her a little bit of respect, Lord.
Yeah, but this is definitely like a culture, like I think for any Black, Indigenous, or people of color culture, it's like, you know, we're kind of like, whoa, you want to ease up, Hagar? It's risky. Yeah. It's a risky road. It has another thing I love about movies like this. And I guess it's somewhat magical realism. You might say it's similar to that. I've had this theory for a long time that, you know, there used to be a conversation that magical realism didn't really work in the States. And my reason for that was always that I don't think that, and maybe this sounds really, really fucked up to some, basically like Black and Indigenous people of color, like communities generally have a closer, they're generally closer to really oppressive environments, communities, harsh events, that lend itself to writing magical realism, because I think you have to have a familiarity with like the absurdity of life when it goes out of control,
like having like an escapist
about, yeah, and like, so it kind of comes, you know, we had that term from the South American writers, and Del Toro talks about the violence he grew up seeing, like he's seen people like beheaded and stuff. So Pan's Labyrinth and those that film comes out of a real lived experience where like life can just go like really sideways. Mm-hmm. And I think that it takes a certain perspective to write that kind of story that is generally lacking in the majority culture in the United States, whereas in the Black community, some of it's there. And like this movie has one of my favorite things in that there's just one single scene of magic, of otherworldliness. And so yeah, I guess we're going to spoil it here, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, listeners, don't, you know, if you're sensitive to spoilers, just check, you know, check back in, and or maybe we can put a little noise or something. Yeah, this is the one good one. It's when Eli walks on water. Mm. Like it's such a great moment in the film. You know, Igbo Landing is such a recurring and powerful story within the Black American community. And just to, like, kind of have that relived that way was, like, really cool to see.
Yeah, the movie has, like, it has a tone where it feels not magical, but mystical, and I think a lot of it has to do with the score. Like they use, I don't know if it's a zither or a harp, but it feels like almost angelic, like you're in this heavenly land. And two, with like a lot of the outfits in this movie are amazing. And like all the women on the beach wearing white, it feels very like heavenly almost. Or I don't know if I talked about it on the podcast, maybe, I don't know, pre-COVID times, but Picnic at Hanging Rock. It's a movie that's very similar to this, where like both in terms of those costumes and sort of like the tone of the movie. I wonder if Julie Dash drew a little bit of an inspiration from that from the half hour of the commentary that I listened to. The only movie that she alluded to really liking was Akira Kurosawa's Ikiru.
Mm.
And she just talks about like the way he blocks things and the way he presents a scene of really pulling from that. And it's actually a movie that I haven't seen. It's like one of my biggest blind spots. So I don't know the specifics, but I thought that was I thought that was an interesting comp.
I was looking for the, I can't find the soundtrack. One thing that's kind of interesting is Julie Dash did music videos for a group called Sweet Honey and the Rock, which is one, it's sort of like a, they're all singers. It's like a, they sing like traditional gospel. They do some African chant. It's like a 90s, like black cultural singing group. And some of, I could, it would make sense if, because they do some music like that. Some of that's in the movie. I can't find the soundtrack.
She also did a Tracy Chapman music video and a Tony.
I think you got one too many in there.
That's from a pop star. Tim Meadows' character was the fourth member, and it was called Tony.
Question mark.
Anyways. Is there anything else about this movie that you guys wanted to mention? It's like a tough movie to go scene by scene to do an analysis in that way. It's much more like a theme oriented movie. It's very unusual, but I think really it's a special movie in that way. And it's the type of movie that, so this is the second time I've seen it. It really, and it makes rewatching it more valuable. I think I got like knowing sort of the tone and knowing that you really have to pay attention to how things are phrased, like the subtext of the way people are talking. I think I got more out of it this time, even than the first time. And I loved it the first time. Like I was telling you guys, I had this, I made a list of like my favorite movies that I saw for the first time the year I watched this, and it was my number five. But yeah, this is like a, it's a 5-star movie for me for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I was like really, I was frustrated with myself that I never sat down and watched it before recently. Cause it's, man, it's rich. It's up there now, like just my favorite, especially like talking about black films that are made here in the US. Like, wow. It's definitely a treasure. And I don't know of any other movie is explicitly about the Gullah people. So that's really, really important. I know right now they've been going through a really rough time around keeping the land that they have. So definitely, hopefully, listeners be aware of that, that like this is a real group of people that are really dealing with a lot of the same pressures that like Native and Indigenous groups deal with around keeping their land safe from corporations and pollution and things like that. It's like really frustrating that that's still such an issue.
Eva, any final thoughts?
The thing that that I really liked about, especially like as the movie wrapped up, was this idea of feeling connected to land. You know, Nana says that she's staying, you know, she's not going anywhere, but you know, that's, and she kind of says it like in front of her husband's grave, like she can't leave because she can't leave her husband.
Mm.
And the people who choose to stay with her. Because, you know, there's a feeling of that like, we can't leave her or we have to take care of her. She's connected to the land. And this Iona's, when the love letter, which I just loved. I love that letter so much. Because it was so empty of all of the things that we're led to expect from, like, you know, late 1800s love letters. He just basically tells her, like, you know, we've known each other a long time. And... but then
I don't think he even says I love you. It's just like,
no, it's something much more like
better.
Yeah, it's something much more like concrete. mm-hmm. that they understand each other. And also he says it, that he's connected to the land there.
Mm-hmm.
And Iona bails out of the boat and comes back on land to be with him, to stay there. I wondered, Nick, if this was, especially like the parts where the characters are talking about leaving Nana behind and leaving that place behind and probably not seeing it again. Is that something that like your family immigrant experience you thought about? Like how that would have looked for your family to have that conversation at some point in time?
I didn't think about it. I mean, maybe I should have. maybe I'm too like solipsistic where I only think about my own, like I was born here. My mom was born here. So all of our like direct family, mm-hmm. Was here, but you know, now that you mention it, like, we do. So I wasn't like the more like, you know, second cousins, my mom's cousins, their parents. So some of them live in California and, you know, we used to see them maybe every couple years or so when we were younger, when like the matriarch and patriarch of their families were still alive, like my grandma's brother, they would all come and like we would hang out. They have a kid who's, I think, exactly my age, actually. She's a doctor now. So the last time I saw her was at my aunt's wedding. That was like 5 years ago. But, you know, we're friends with them on Facebook. But so her grandmother, the last time I saw her was when I was in college. So that was, I think it was my second year of college. So it's been about 15 or 16 years since I've seen her. Her name's Auntie Rosita. She's the loveliest person I know. She's a small Chinese woman who lives in the Philippines. And when I saw her that time, it had been like at least 5 years since I'd seen her. And we had dinner together and she just did the Chinese grandma thing where like if my plate was halfway empty, she would like fill it to the top so that it was like brimming with food again. And so my parents went to the Philippines last year to see with my aunt and then a couple of my cousins to see her, to see some of her kids who are like my mom's cousins and some other family members. And I mean, that's, my mom was saying like not too long ago, she's like, that's probably the last time we're ever actually going to see Auntie Rosita. Like she's in her like mid to late 80s. She's doing okay for, you know, someone who's in her mid to late 80s. She's still all there, but she's not traveling the United States. And if she does travel to the United States, it's to San Francisco to see her kid. She's not coming to Ohio and it's, you know, not convenient to go to the Philippines. So, you know, she's not someone who I was like, who I've been particularly close with, but you know, I've from the times I have seen her that it's, you know, it's like one of my mom said that I was like, you know, that is sad because every time I've seen her, it's been, you know, she's very sweet. Sure. She's like more like my grandma, my Chinese grandma than anyone else I know. You know, I guess that's upsetting. I never really heard from my grandparents though, like much about their immigrant experience. Really, I think they didn't like to talk about it because I know like my grandpa had family members who had like fucked up stuff happen to them when they left. But that also like that coupled with, you know, they left China sort of as a family. So most of them who didn't end up in the States ended up in the Philippines. So they would still see them periodically. Yeah. So I think it was probably easier for them rather than like this, you know, this kind of cut is permanent. Whereas that was, you know, they were doing it in the 50s. You were able to travel a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different situation, but yeah, I mean, it's a good point.
Yeah. Like, you know, getting, you know, I found a relative on ancestry.com, like it really happens. So he and I have been in touch for a few months now. And so it's my dad's grandmother came to this country with her children when they were small. She and her brother came too, her brother and his wife, and they lived like a couple blocks away from each other. I found out, you know, through this, that they had a brother and sister who stayed. And, you know, by talking to this person who's my cousin, like, about why they left, I'm like, I have no idea why they left or like, you know, what it was. And he said, you know, was it, you know, out of like desperation or just like impending like political climate or, you know, I didn't know anything. And he says, no, they had decent jobs. They had property. They owned their own homes. He said it was political. And so that just made me wonder even more, like, you know, was there a disagreement between, you know, some of them believed a certain thing and they left and the others disagreed with them and stayed. And I never knew. I had always pictured that once they came to America, that there was no contact with the rest of their families anymore. And I've come to find out that no, there was a ton for like 40 years until they all died, that they would write each other letters really frequently, and more, you know, my great grandma was sending money and clothes and medicine to her sisters, to her sister, for her sister to give to her grandchildren. And yeah, they knew each other. It's really strange because nobody ever told me that out loud. They just didn't talk about it.
Yeah, these kinds of just like family migration and all that stuff. It's so interesting. We found out a couple of years ago that my dad's granddad, like, we have Gabonese ancestry, like, and it looks like he came to this country from Gabon. And yet, other than that, there's like very little knowledge of, like, nobody knows why, like, why he immigrated, especially the time that he did. It would have been like the 1900s. Yeah, it would have been around like when this movie was made, that he traveled here. So just really, you know, finding out that story of why it happened is always, I think that's always difficult.
Yeah, and we only ever hear the story of the person who came. You know, right. We don't ever get really a chance to hear about,
like, Nana's story.
Or the people who, yeah, like, for that family, you know, what are they, the family that moves north, what are they ever going to know about you?
Right.
Deep stuff.
Good movie.
Yeah.
Man, I'm glad we decided to talk about this, because it had been a few years since I'd seen it, and I'm really, really glad I got to revisit this. It's an awesome movie. And like we said at the start of the show, Criterion's got a lot of stuff available for free right now. I don't know how long that's going to last, but
yeah,
hopefully it'll last for a little while. So this is one of them. I don't know. Like, I have a subscription, so I'm not sure what else is free on there, but they've got a decent, I know that, like, their initial announcement anyway was a decent selection of like Black filmmakers that they were featuring. So if you want to see this, if you haven't seen it yet, or if you want to see those, head over to criterionchannel.com and watch some good stuff. So that was Daughters of the Dust, 1991 or 1992. I keep seeing it pop up as different years.
It took her a few years to make it, I think, was the problem.
Yeah.
And then maybe there was a delay in when it was actually released too.
Yeah, I think that there's a difference between like the festival versus actual release date is different from site to site. But anyways, early 90s. Cool movie. If you see it and have thoughts, you can let us know at facebook.com/onthetropes or onthetropes.gmail.com @gmail.com.
Really?
Twitter.com/onthetropes. You can get some loot at onthetropes.redbubble.com. I got a couple things from Redbubble recently, and I'm pretty happy with them. So if you wanna get some stuff over there, I got stickers for the back of my computer. You guys will see that once we have a vaccine and we can do this shit in person again. I hate the times we live in. And you can throw some money our way at patreon.com/onthetropes. Do we have plans for our next episode? We're talking about doing prison escape movies, which I'd love to do.
Oh, yeah.
I've like recently decided that I've gone like full dad and just really embrace the prison escape movies now. It's a very like dad movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
A dad genre of movie.
Yeah, it pretty much is. Yeah, I'm down for that next.
Cool. On air production meeting. As always, I am your host, Nick.
I'm Sir.
I'm Eva.
And Kyle. And yeah, join us next week when we're going to talk prison escape movies.